I'm very pleased. My name is Bill Thoet. I'm a partner at Booz Allen Hamilton. I'm very pleased to be able to moderate this panel on a very important topic on disenfranchised youth. And one of the focus areas is not just the economic effects of that and the humanitarian effects that we all know, but also the stability effects of disenfranchised youth on the world. One of the areas that clearly is an area of interest today is Islamic terrorism, which is certainly supported by disenfranchised youth in that area. But this isn't a new problem. It's a long-standing problem that goes back to any time we've had sort of youth bulges in the past, all the way back to the Dark Ages and right after the Black Plague. There were instabilities in Europe that were fueled by disenchanted youth, lack of opportunity, etc. The issues here are also not just regional, they're global. And there are issues in sub-Saharan Africa, there are issues in the Middle East. We've heard a lot of discussions in the last few days about the demographics of the world changing and the importance of those demographics. In the more developed world basically having an age bulge as opposed to a youth bulge. So there are lots of aspects that are giving rise to this problem. Now, the question is, what drives the youth in those conditions to radicalism? And what are the ways that we can avoid that radicalism or change the situation that exists today? The problem is not a simple problem that has a simple solution. It's a problem that has to look across all of the elements of society, from government to NGOs to civil society, to address it. And we want to look at that as a holistic problem. We'll look at sort of bringing the mega community together to look at this problem. I'm honored to introduce three distinguished panelists. Queen Noor of Jordan, she plays a very major role in promoting international exchange and understanding of not only Middle Eastern policies, but also international policies, especially around youth. She won the UNICEF's Children Champion Award due to her work in landmine awareness for many children across the world getting maimed or killed by landmines that are left from conflicts that may be decades old. Kate Roberts is the founder and director of Youth AIDS. I had a very interesting discussion with her over lunch the other day and got a little bit of a knowledge of her background. As I put it, not she put it, she's an ad executive gone good. She spent much of her early youth basically selling cigarettes and Coca-Cola and things like that in
not literally
in the in Eastern Europe. Sort of went through an epiphany after traveling to Africa and decided that the same techniques that she had used to sell youth on things that were bad for them, she could sell youth on things that are good for them. And so she started an organization called Youth AIDS to drive advertising and celebrity to change the view of youths towards the AIDS problem. Ambassador Karim Kawar is the Jordanian ambassador to the U.S. and Mexico. He's been that since 2002. He's also the founding member of several business associations and non-government organizations, and has been very active in the Aspen Ideas Fest. I think we've done about four panels thus far. So I wanted to, again, give a brief introduction and then kind of have each of the panelists give a little bit of their perspective of what are some important issues in here. And we'd like to keep it more informal and more of a dialogue than and involve the audience earlier rather than later. I've seen in a lot of panels the audience doesn't get to ask a lot of the questions they'd like to. Queen Noor?
Well, good morning. We do want to be brief, so I'm going to try to be brief about a very complex problem that has many, many dimensions that range from unemployment, poor education, many of the things you mentioned, political radicalization, healthcare limitations, poverty, and conflict. And just a few basic statistics. can help to lay out the problem worldwide. There are over 50 million babies in the world who are not registered. That's 41% of births worldwide. These are people who have no national political identity, and you can imagine what happens as they develop and grow and are seeking out opportunities and also a potential burden if they don't have that national identity in their countries. 120 million primary school-age children are not in school. 53% of those are girls, and I think that's a very important statistic, and I'll come back to it. 180 million children in the worst forms of child labor imaginable. Every year, 1.2 million children are trafficked, and 42 million children in 27 countries lose their parents to AIDS, or are expected to by 2010, and Kate will talk a lot more about that. The genocide in Rwanda has left tens of thousands of orphans, and to just add to the other orphans in Africa, and again, I'm sure you'll talk about that. Child soldiers are being used in more than 30 countries around the world. Some 300,000 children are serving, and again, Kate and I will both talk about that from Africa and Latin American perspectives, perhaps. So billions of dollars are being spent to fight terrorism, crime, and insurgencies around the world. Peacemaking, struggling for stability in various regions, which was part of the title of this panel, is so often viewed as a matter of politics and negotiations, statecraft and diplomacy, of proposals and counterproposals. But really, truly, some of these statistics I hope have made it clear, the seeds of discord are in areas where you have poverty, frustration, and hopelessness. King Hussein once said, "It should never be forgotten that peace resides ultimately not in the hands of governments, but in the hands of people. For unless peace can be made real to the men, women, and children of the Middle East, the best efforts of negotiators will come to naught." So we established a foundation after his death to try to focus on those objectives, focusing on education, and because education is such a key component in providing young people alternative ways of thinking, if it emphasizes critical thinking, creative thinking, science and technology, and the skills that can help young people imagine how they might take part in our globalizing world instead of feeling marginalized. And focusing also on women and the importance of programs that emphasize their role as their economic role in society. Traditionally, women in our region and probably throughout the developing world were focused on as more charity recipients and people to just help along, but not really to see as potential dynamic actors in economic development. So then we have a leadership prize. Again, the King is saying leadership prize focused on trying to provide next generation peace builders a voice and a platform. In our part of the world, 50% of our population is under the age of 18. 70% of the Arab world is under the age of 30. I think Ambassador Kawar will speak a little bit to that. Our biggest challenge is that we are a rich nation of poor people, poor in many ways, not just economically, and there is rampant poverty in our region, but poor in knowledge, poor in access to science and technology, poor in terms of women's participation. And we know that when girls, educated girls, contribute to economic productivity, lower infant and maternal mortality rates, safer childbirth, higher nutrition status, reduced poverty, and play, and again, Kate will address this, I'm sure, can play an active role, many believe, in eradicating the threat of HIV/AIDS and other diseases. They can contribute fully to political, social, and economic development. When they're denied education, they're vulnerable to poverty, hunger, violence, abuse, exploitation, and trafficking. So I probably said enough, and I have more on women in particular in our region points that actually apply to the importance of eliminating barriers for women to education. And also that show, one point I'd love to make is in the Arab world, data shows that in the past decade, girls outperform boys in almost every academic area. And they have a much lower repetition rate than boys. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's one of the reasons that there are so many obstacles to their remaining in school, but it shows what an untapped resource we have. And as I said, that really is the key to trying to create the conditions that will enable alternatives to the sense of frustration and hopelessness that so many young people feel in our region because of poverty, because of lack of access, because of health problems and others. So let me stop there and hand over to you, Kate.
Well, I'm also going to keep it very brief. As Bill said, I took a trip to Africa about 7 years ago and in my Gucci shoes. And I looked around and asked a couple of questions because I was seeing funerals on every corner. And it was just not my world, and I couldn't figure it out. And after doing some research, I was told that one in four 14-year-old schoolgirls were already infected with HIV. On going to villages in South Africa, in rural areas, I was meeting little boys who were 8 years old who were caring for their families of siblings, six or seven kids in this mud hut that the eight-year-old boy was looking after. He had no access to education or family or role models at all. Oops. His biggest challenge was where his next bowl of porridge was coming from. On the subject of AIDS, we obviously have, it's developing an economic crisis. In sub-Saharan Africa alone, in about 5 years, if we don't do something about the problem, we'll have more than 100 million orphans and no jobs. In fact, the youth generation is in jeopardy because of predominantly the situation of HIV/AIDS. I was told this morning that in Africa, in 10 years, I think it is, over the next 10 years, we'll have 300,000 child soldiers, which is mind-blowing. In fact, the ambassador this morning Googled the words disenfranchised youth, and what came up immediately was that we have 6 million of them in the U.S. alone. Which was, again, astounding. As Queen Noor said, that we have an enormous problem around the world, which we can explore, and Queen Noor is an expert on empowering women. And I think if we can give women the tools to be able to negotiate what they want and give them a voice, I think that is going to be a big solution. I was recently in India, and I went to the brothels over there. Is that me? Moisture, okay. that's a good word. Yeah. We need some more moisture, yeah. So I was recently in the brothels in India. And I was absolutely flabbergasted by what I saw. This particular brothel that we crawled into with our global ambassador, Ashley Judd, there's four different levels of cages where the women are enslaved. And they have been sold by their parents as young as 9 years old because of just sheer lack of money in the family and pure poverty for $50. And they're required to stay in the brothel until they've paid off their debt, which, of course, they never can. On the top level, the women were privileged enough to be able to leave the brothel once a month to get rid of their sexually transmitted diseases. So there are horrendous things going on around the world, but I do feel that there is a lot of hope, and the hope lies in the young people. And I believe that young people recognize their problem and they really are willing to do something about it. But what they need is education, resources, and I feel that we're responsible for providing those to them, but also providing them alternatives. When I was in Africa, I realized that there was a big gap in the NGO world, and an opportunity for us to develop communications that target this group that is the most vulnerable to all these different paths that they could take. I think we need to work on drawing young people into our communities, giving them the resources that they can be part of the solution, giving them a voice. One thing that we've done that's worked very well, because it's all about looking at the culture of that country, whether it be Africa, whether it be India, whether it be the United States, and looking at what works about reaching these young people. And we've really tapped into pop culture. One thing that works all over the world is soccer. I think we realized that with the World Cup coming up on the finals on Sunday. These soccer players are so powerful with the message. You know, whether you're a kid in a mud hut, football, soccer, but they're all American.
I know.
They
no,
say
no,
soccer.
They're not all American. You're right.
Yeah. Soccer, football. It's taken me years to say soccer, and now I have to say football again. but these football soccer players, whether you're a kid in a mud hut in Botswana or, you know, a young person in Jordan or India, you're going to know who your football player is. And what we've done in a lot of these countries is we've and it's not about your international football player, it's about your local football player. And I was telling a story the other day on a different panel about in Africa, I went to visit a program in I think it was Tanzania, and I went into a mud hut hairdresser, and they had no... Oh, is it me?
No, I'll just switch.
Okay. I went into a little mud hut hairdresser in the middle of nowhere with no electricity or running water or power, but there was a poster of Beyoncé from Destiny's Child. So, and, you know, the women wanted to look like her, so they were getting their hair braided. These women are illiterate. They have not been to school. So what do you have there? You have an audience and you have a hairdresser. So if you can teach the hairdresser can teach on to her clients. And that's a great way of reaching young people with messages that you need them to get. A lot of these young people living in these villages all over the world do not have access to education. So you need to tap into local cultures and the built-in infrastructure that is already there to reach them with these relevant messages. And, you know, the one thing that I'd like to end this on, and I'll pass it over to the ambassador, is that music is very damaging. I think you've all heard of Eminem and his violent lyrics that I've heard young people talk about Eminem and how they look. I mean, he's a huge star all over the world. And he talks about rape and killing his mother, killing his girlfriend or his wife. And I believe that we have a big opportunity with music to really reach young people with these messages, because they will listen to those lyrics and those lyrics will change behavior. So we actually do hip hop forums around the world. We're actually doing one in DC for the disenfranchised youth of Washington. I announced yesterday that in DC alone, 1 in 10 African American women are infected with HIV. You know, how is that possible? That's the same prevalence as Haiti. You know, how is that possible in the richest and most powerful capital in the world to have that sort of AIDS problem? So we try to go to the source and offer solutions that are culturally relevant by tapping into these mediums.
Thank you. Okay. Well, allow me first to start, since Her Majesty Queen Noor shared some of the statistics. By Jordanian standards, I'm considered a senior citizen.
both of us.
And hopefully, since Jordan is probably overrepresented on this panel, that doesn't signify the problem, but hopefully a window on the solution that we might provide for our part of the world. In Jordan, we are spending today over 5% of our GDP on education. We offer universal education. It's mandatory through 10th grade to the age of 15, and hopefully we can raise that. We are ranked 26th in the world, according to UNESCO, in offering equal education to boys and girls. Today, we have more women in our universities than men. We have found that unemployment rates have been steady. Actually, they have come down slightly, but I think that is probably superficial given the growth rate that we have. Today, in Jordan, every year we need to create, for a population of 5.5 million, we need to create over 60,000 new jobs to maintain unemployment at the level that it is, which is already high. It's the unemployment rate is over 14% officially. Unofficially, it could be in the high teens, maybe low 20s. That would be quite drastic in other societies. In Jordan, we have a very strong social safety net where the extended family caters to those that are unemployed, so you don't see any homeless people in Jordan as such. And I think probably that's a negative thing in terms of the family caring for those who are unemployed, because they get too comfortable and don't are not encouraged to find jobs. But this is actually one of the biggest challenges that I see. Today, if you look at the Arab world, that's comprised of 22 countries, where the population stands over 300 million, that population is going to double by the year 2020. It will reach over 600 million people. We need to create 100 million new jobs in the next 15 years to maintain the unemployment rate at the level that it is, which is high. And I cannot see a bigger challenge than that in our region. So Jordan, 60,000 jobs. If you look at Egypt, it's over 800,000 jobs a year, new jobs that need to be created. And there isn't enough momentum there to meet that demand. What we are doing specifically in Jordan is we are looking at those unemployment rates, and we find them to be the highest among the youth, and especially with those who just have high school education with no experience. They can't find the jobs that are needed. We do suffer from a brain drain. Many Jordanians do seek job opportunities elsewhere. Given that, and out of our 25 universities, we offer some of the most advanced education fields in the region, which at a subsidized rate, so that brain drain does come at a cost as well. But when we see where there is a mismatch between our education system in the past and the job market, since that youth bulge cannot be accommodated for in the job market. So what we have done is we have transformed our education system from a teaching-based system to a learning-based system. We're teaching in all public schools English and computer literacy, starting from grade one, and we have been doing that over the past 6 years. That has also changed the role of the teacher. The teacher is becoming a facilitator. But what we are trying to do is to open the horizons. When Luma and I went through our education system, the teacher would walk into our classroom and would just dump whatever information he or she had on us and would not be very tolerant of questions. I wasn't sure. My teachers didn't like the questions I asked. I wasn't sure it was me or the questions. But this is what we are trying to change, is to change that whole culture. Today in Jordan, our youth and our voting system it starts at the age of 18. But many of our youth complain that they reach that age without making real decisions in their life early on. Everything is decided for them. And this is what is changing as well. So, for example, in our education system, you go through 12 years, and at the end of high school, you take an examination, general examination. What you get as a score determines what you study in university. So if you get 96% and above, you're admitted into the School of Medicine, 93% and above School of Engineering, and so on. The lowest performers in our education system were admitted into the School of Sharia, Islamic Law, or Journalism, which explains Al Jazeera.
I'm not so sure he was trying to be funny.
It's true.
That's really sad.
What we have done is we have phased out of that system. So Sharia, Islamic law, now is requires the same grade as general law or corporate law. And we have phased out Islamic law from the undergraduate studies. So now it's offered at the master's level, where we encourage the clergy to study different disciplines before becoming Islamic scholars. And that, I believe, is an important issue. So I talked about education, but the other challenge that we face is frankly, and this is not just in the Arab or the Muslim world, but it's also in Europe, when we look at radicalism within Islam, and what His Majesty King Abdullah has been doing over the past 2 years, looking at those horrific crimes that we have seen carried out in the name of Islam. First and foremost, he said, how could those people be Muslim? King Abdullah is the 43rd generation direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, and he has moral authority that is regarded by many, and he uses that very judicially in saying you cannot be a Muslim and kill innocent people, just as Islam is a continuation of the Abrahamic tradition. It is the same principles and values as Christianity and Judaism, and it's not any different in its teachings. So what King Abdullah started 2 years ago is what is known as the Amman message, saying we want the return to traditional Islam. When the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he respected those who practiced other faiths and religions, and who are accepted in Islam. So Islam is a religion of peace, and this is what we are trying to reinforce, that Islam does not condone violence. And that this is the first time, last July, actually, a year ago, that 180 Muslim clergy and scholars from 42 countries, including the United States, met in Amman, Jordan, our capital, and they agreed on a set of principles. This was the first time, actually, that the 8 schools of jurisprudence, the 4 Sunni schools, the 2 Shia schools, the Zaydis and the Ibadis from Yemen and Oman, have recognized each other. And this was historic. This has not been done in the past 1,400 years. And hopefully that will be also the start to overcome some of the conflicts within the Muslim world. Another point that this conference stressed is that no one in the Muslim world has the right to call another an apostate or an infidel, which is what the tactic that Osama bin Laden and Zarqawi were using by declaring anybody an infidel or an enemy of Islam and therefore would launch holy war against that person or that community. That the conference in Amman took that right away from anybody. Nobody has the right to call another an apostate or an infidel. And hopefully that will be a major step forward, because those radicals within our society are referred to as takfiris. And that's the method that they apply. In some of them, if you do not believe in exactly the same things that they do, they will consider you an outlaw. So hopefully with those steps, that with the endorsement that we have from the Muslim world at large, since those recommendations from the Amman conference were later adopted by the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Conference, which represents 56 Muslim countries. That was held in Mecca, and that endorsed all of those findings and this communique that came out of that conference. So hopefully this will be a major step forward. And during the past few days, I've been hearing some comments that moderate Muslims are not speaking out. Moderate Muslims are speaking out, but unfortunately the media here doesn't carry those stories. It's sometimes, it is about timing as well. That conference concluded on the 7th of July 2005, which was the same day that the bombings took place in London. And the media just shifted on the covering the London incidents instead. So we hope that through you we can get this message out more and more, that there are moderate Muslim leaders who are ready to take that personal risk of standing up to their faith, to speak for what they believe in, and to defend that religion, which is a religion of peace. It is a religion of not only tolerance, but also acceptance and mutual respect, that hopefully, that I can say as someone who represents the small Christian minority in Jordan, I have lived in a country that have given me my full rights, and I would not have been in Washington had there been any discrimination against Christians or people of other faiths in Jordan. So we hope that in Jordan we can present models for overcoming some of the challenges that our youth and our population will face. Thank you.
I think the ambassador introduced some ideas of how one government is focusing on this issue, but I think the issue is also broader than what governments alone can do. So I wanted to have a little bit of a discussion about what the role of government is, business and the private sector, but also civil society in providing solutions and opportunities for these youth.
Actually, I would just like to to add to what the ambassador has said. I think religion and the church is so powerful around the world, whether it be Islam, the Catholic, the Roman Catholic Church. I would say that 40%, and I'm throwing this figure out there just based on my travels and my experience around the world, 40% of youth really listen to the church. And I think that we have a really good platform to collaborate with faith-based organizations to also change behavior in the church and to give them the tools and the messages that they need to get to young people.
Let me add one thing as well. In 2002 or 2003, a Zoghbi poll on the Arab world showed that religion was the second priority among a list of priorities of concern for Arab youth. In 2005, the priorities were in the order of employment, healthcare, corruption, education, and combating extremism. And religion, this doesn't mean that Arab youth are not interested or concerned or influenced by religion, but it showed that their priorities were very pragmatic, and it indicates that there's an opportunity there for religion and mm-hmm. for religious figures mm-hmm. to be able to focus more on what are the priority concerns mm-hmm. in a constructive way, that it isn't just blanket, you know, religion as a solution, but in fact they recognize that there are other priorities that are extremely important. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I think this presents an opportunity mm-hmm. for, it doesn't mean that they're any less devout, but mm-hmm. it does mean that there's an opportunity there for state and private actors mm-hmm. to try to focus on.
Well, and instead of, as was mentioned, using the power of the religious persuasion, which mm-hmm. they haven't given up, but they just don't have concerns, to help influence them in the right directions as well.
So I believe civil society has a big role to play. One of the examples would be a program called INJAZ, which was done in cooperation with the USAID in Jordan. That is modeled after the Junior Achievement Organization that has focused on the group between the age of 14 and 21 in presenting them with business skills so that they grow up to be more in tune with the business community or trying to find their opportunities to instill entrepreneurship at an early age. Say in our education system, what we have found is that the largest employer used to be the government. So our universities catered to the largest employer, so they were perfect at churning out bureaucrats. And that's what we did not want. So now we are shifting a lot of that, but certainly the business community also provides through their resources. You have CEOs that come and meet with those high school students and try to talk to them about what their aspirations can be and what they can achieve once they're out of the education system, and just to broaden their horizon in all of the opportunities that lie ahead and where they would be better prepared to find the job to accept that job.
I think the ambassador's point is so important because what, of course, he's saying is that this is providing young people something to look ahead to. Mm-hmm. And even at the early stages, it's just giving them horizons, whether they're economic or otherwise. And this is why critical thinking and an emphasis on the diversity as a source of strength in society, in the school system, which has not really been the case until now, is very, very important. And I say that because otherwise, the alternative is, and this is an extreme case, tragically, in the Middle East Strategy Group, which is a part of the Aspen Institute, and we meet in Washington and out here, a Palestinian member of the group or contributor to the group a few weeks ago said that 36% of Palestinian young people think that the best option for them when they reach the age of 18, which I think is interesting, they're seeing it as when they reach maturity, is to become a suicide bomber. And that is because they have no horizon of opportunities or alternatives in front of them. And I think that's very telling about why currently today I think there's an enormous misjudgment about how to deal with turbulence and disaffection and even violence in areas like that through more violence and more suppression and restrictions, rather than seeing, there isn't a recognition, I think, that you're further radicalizing so many young people who are just looking for the kinds of opportunities that we've been talking about, and that the international donor community should be focusing on providing rather than cutting off all avenues for these young people just for political purposes.
If I may follow up on that, Tom Friedman in a Discovery Times production, it was called Straddling the Fence, 2 years ago he did a documentary, and he actually interviewed some of the would-be suicide bombers. And surprisingly, their aspirations were to come and study at American universities and to have a bright future. But unfortunately, they see that wall stopping them from reaching those aspirations in their hopes.
I think wherever we are in the world, youth are youth. They all have aspirations. They all have a voice, and I think a lot of the time they feel frustrated because they're not able to express themselves, which leads to situations that we've been discussing. And I think there are so many simple solutions out there as long as they're culturally and locally relevant. One example would be in Rwanda, which is a war-torn country with limited resources. We've set up a center, a youth center, as simple as that. It's actually called Think About It. And there's now these centers all over Rwanda. And it's a place for young people to go to talk about all the issues that they're feeling amongst each other. There's also a radio show that goes out of the center that youth can call into or be part of. There's activities set up for them. And what happens in these centers is they get education so that they can train on. So then it's peers speaking to peers, kids speaking to kids, like speaking to like. And it just gives them a platform and somewhere to go to voice their frustrations and to get information. And that can happen anywhere in the world based on the culture.
I want to follow up on an earlier point that was made by Queen Noor about the empowerment of women. I think if you look at the demographics of where, one, there is a youth bulge in radicalism, it also in most places coincides with very male-dominated cultures. How would the empowerment of women in those cultures contribute to addressing the issue?
I think one of the key problems in many developing countries, not just the Arab world probably, is that Arab girls, for example, face serious obstacles to completing their schooling or even being enrolled. And they're often withdrawn near or just after puberty, for early marriage, domestic duties, the extra fees and hidden costs of education, which end up families focusing when they have those kinds of constraints on sending boys to school rather than girls. They're withdrawn or not enrolled so that they can contribute to child rearing, supplementing the family income. These are the primary obstacles. If we can eliminate barriers for girls, and this is true for around the world, the long distance that they often have to cover to get to schools, those school fees and other hidden costs, the lack of safe water and sanitation, this is something we talked about earlier today, the discrimination, even the threat of violence for many of them in schools, then I think that's one concrete, those are a variety of things that the international community can help developing countries who don't have the resources to be able to resolve all those costs. That, I think, is one significant area that could make a huge difference.
If I can add to that, women's empowerment is actually one of the biggest problems that we face as an NGO. The situation in most of the world outside the developed world is that women have zero voice. They have no power whatsoever, especially in negotiating sex, for instance, negotiating condom use, or saying no. Especially in Africa, if a woman was to say no, she would get beaten up and raped. At home, one would think that a married woman would be safe, but unfortunately, in a lot of these countries, it's tradition for men on the way home to go and have a drink with the boys and then visit a commercial sex worker on his way home from work. So he will undoubtedly pick up an STD or HIV and then take it home to his wife. Now, so what we're trying to do is encourage women and give them the tools and the ability and the words to use to empower themselves to be able to negotiate condom use even with their husband. The other thing that we need to do is obviously develop these behavior change communications to women. But what's actually even more important is developing these communication techniques to men. And because it's men that have to learn that they have to respect their wives and their partners. And in Africa especially, we have this campaign called Real Men. And it's a real men that do respect their women and their wives. And they do protect themselves and their partners. So I think women's empowerment is such a vital thing that we have to do in all of these countries. And again, respecting the different cultures, because the communications that we would use in Jordan or Sudan or in the Middle East would be completely different to what we would do in India, being primarily Sikh. to Africa, which is, you know, much, much harder.
I'd like to open up questions to the audience, if we have a couple. And please introduce yourself first.
My name is David Hsu. I am by no means an expert in any of these areas, but certainly with the things happening in the world today, feel in some way threatened, but also wanting to understand how we as Americans can help in any way with these issues, because we all live together. In listening to the problem, some certainly seem to be symptoms, some seem to be root causes. If you have to create 100 million jobs in the next 15 million years, isn't ultimately one root cause the ability to create a private sector within some or all of the other countries to create jobs? I wonder, what do you feel the likelihood of that happening is in the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, on that issue in particular, I think you see the Arab world competing with China on attracting foreign direct investment. Frankly, here we would like to attract investments with a cause, realizing that the problems in our part of the world can haunt the rest of the world, and therefore it is important to address those. There has been an initiative undertaken by the young Arab leaders, I think, which will be announced at the Clinton Global Initiative, where they're trying to get American businesses to commit to taking interns from the Arab world, that they would come here and learn how corporate America functions, and they can go back after that internship and contribute to their own corporations or start their own. What we have been doing as countries in the Arab world is actively in acceding or joining the World Trade Organization so that the laws that apply in our land would be the same as the international laws. So for businesses coming to Jordan, for example, you would reduce that risk, at least from the legal environment that the country has. But also, Jordan is the fourth country in the world and the first in the Arab world to enter into a free trade area agreement with the United States. And we are pushing for the Middle East free trade area agreement, where others such as Morocco and Bahrain have already entered into those agreements, and Oman would be next. And hopefully we would normalize the business environment throughout the region. And we want to present this as an opportunity. So for American businesses, looking at the market today of 300 million, that is going to double. What are the opportunities there? And frankly, many of the American businesses that have done business in our part of the world have had a great return on investment. So hopefully we can do a lot more there.
Just to expand on that for a second, you asked, what can you do? And I'm steering it away a little bit from the Middle East, because we really have a global problem here of, potential terrorism, disease, economic instability. And one of the biggest problems that we've got is that government funding for all of these issues is just not enough. And we have lack of resources. And so I've, with my group, been quite successful in a term that we call cause-related marketing. And that's by not just begging for money. It's a model that works with corporations, predominantly in America, but in the developing world, to use their resources to raise more resources. I can give you a great example of this. The Lance Armstrong bracelet raised $80 million for cancer. We just did you might have seen it around America, with Aldo Shoes. Simple. It's a shoe store. It's got 800 stores around the world. It has 100 million young people walking into their stores and buying shoes every year. So we tapped into that and very simply made a military dog tag, and using celebrities to promote the initiative. In 9 months, it raised $3 million, and it's had 1.5 billion media impressions around the world on the subject of AIDS prevention. So it's a great way of reaching young people. And from that campaign, online, we've been able to track this, kids have been emailing each other, they've been on the internet, that we know that they've been going through to the website because there's been millions of hits from all over the world, so we know that kids are getting educated. So to answer your question, there is so much that an American corporation can do with their brands, with their employees, and with their resources, and we just need to tap into that. It's not going to cost you any money.
I would also add that, and I think this might apply in other parts of the world, but it's not only about economies. It's also about fighting intolerance and radicalism by fostering mutual understanding and dialogue, finding ways to strengthen moderate voices, to create and open up, and this is a problem we have in our region, the political space and horizons for young people so that, and encourage ways in which they can participate in public life as even adolescents so that they see from that age the avenues that are open to them. And also to ensure that that there's access by poor families to services and safety nets that are needed to protect and care for their children, and this is not just economic, but it's also in other areas, health and otherwise.
Okay. Another question over here.
I was intrigued by your comment about 100 million jobs in 15 years, and India has to produce about 250 million jobs in the next 15
Oof.
Years.
I was trying to size the problem.
Uh-oh.
But
we can keep going.
Okay, well,
yeah.
I thought it was maybe something I said.
Think Shakespeare.
There are some economists who would argue that some of those jobs will be created just by the mere growth of population and on a small scale. You will need to cater to the needs of the population, and that creates opportunities from within. But certainly, India is a great example about investment in education. If you look at the IT sector in India that has been booming, I believe there are many opportunities there. But the challenge, and I'm not sure, I don't really know the demographics in India, whether does it share the same problems as well in the youth or not?
I think it's growing.
That's the bigger challenge.
About 60% under 25.
Right. And if you, and I think it's also important to look at percentages. You know, what those, I don't know how many current jobs India has, but the 100 million that we're talking about in the Arab world is probably double what the current jobs that are available today. So in that sense, it is probably a greater challenge. But those are common challenges.
I think my only comment was that it would be useful to share what the Indians are trying to do. They have actually a lot of the same issues. They have a very small employment base on which they're trying to build a new employment. They have, you know, a lot of the same sorts of situations, problems, and they're looking at similar solutions. So I just think that would be
good. And that's very much welcomed.
It also brings up an interesting point, which is the nexus between the MENA region and the challenges which the ambassador has laid out. We've been talking about aging in Europe, migration, and the social, political, and economic impact of all of these. Can we integrate our disenfranchised or, let's say, opportunity-challenged youth into the global labor force, into other parts of the world where that they can make a contribution, and in what ways can we do this? where they are not challenged by assimilation and the other constraints that we've seen in Europe that have created ghettos and created, you know, some of the same challenges that we face in our regions, but recognizing that I think we have to look at this globally and we have to focus on our own regions and we have to try to make the improvements that we've been talking about, but at the same time, where you do have high population rates and then negative population rates, you know, there should be a global strategy to look at what's possible, I think.
May I suggest logistically that if we could take multiple questions at the time,
yes,
I think we can hear also.
Yeah, we'll take five questions and select a couple.
This gentleman at the back in the blue shirt.
Oh, and there's also one over there.
Okay.
For your information, there is a program based in America that is now worldwide that is some kind of a solution to some of this. It's called the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. NIFDES, it's an acronym. I'm very involved with it in the Washington, D.C. area, but it has been burgeoning worldwide. We are in India. Where the organization is in every school now in the United Kingdom. They're totally taken into it. It's in Ireland, Belgium, Amsterdam. It's in Latin America. The founder created a book. It's an easy MPA. And the organization teaches teachers to teach entrepreneurship. And in the schools, the kids have to at least write and defend a business plan. So all of a sudden, education becomes relevant for them. Math, writing, looking somebody in the eye, shaking a hand. Schools that are funded by corporations can actually give seed capital to the kids, and they actually start their own little companies and write and defend business plans on their own companies. I happen to work with the kids. We have a program in Washington called Adopt a Class. Bring corporations into the classroom. So
that's
they
great.
Have the role models, they have the money, and they're actually doing it. And at the end of the day, the kids stand and tall and look you in the eye and can talk about market strategy. They've been through case studies, and they either have the drive then to start their own business or become employable because they understand the bigger picture of business. So is the whole organization available to you?
Thank you.
I would just let's take a couple more. We're going to try to finish up around 11:30 here, so one of our speakers can make another engagement. Go ahead.
Yeah, the lunch at 12.
We're sharing solutions. I'm the president of Youth Build USA, which has engaged the 6 million, a few, engaged 60,000 of the 6 million young people in the United States. In a particular approach. get back on track to complete their high school diploma. All of them have been, almost all of them have been high school dropouts. And then either to go on to college or to go into the trades, but with a big emphasis in this process on their voice in the solutions, on their being part of making policy, engaging with politicians, of governing their own program, even of hiring staff. Because what you all said about how eager they are to be part of the solution is what we found is that the young people who have, in the United States, been disenfranchised, disconnected, even in prison, foster care on the streets, really want hope for an existence that has meaning. They don't just want a low-wage dead-end job, especially in the United States. Now, we've begun to work in Central America, South Africa, and various other locations, and we're asked by USAID to do parallel to what you described. I think it's nifty what you described.
Junior achievement,
similar. NIFTY is very good in junior achievement program. To do that in Palestine, but it was canceled because Hamas won. But what I would be really interested in exploring is whether you think that this idea of employing the young people, you pay them while they build housing and while they're also going to school. Where the funds might come from, whether there's an opportunity in the developing world to do that, or whether microfinance is really the only approach to creating all these jobs.
Okay.
We'll get a couple more, and then we'll...
Just quickly talk about solutions-based approach as opposed to a media-based approach. Before we can even start doing skills training and so forth, the one thing with... I'm Cameron Sinclair. I've been working about 10 countries on reconstruction. The one thing that we really need to do is actually build facilities that engage people. Mm-hmm. For instance, you can't build a school without having clean water. Mm-hmm. You can't build a school without having toilets.
So true.
So, you know, and this is something we learned, especially with getting women in school. Mm-hmm. The other comment I want to make is that there's been a lot of stress in the last week and a half about women's education, and it's something that is a priority for us, and we're heavily involved in, especially with HIV/AIDS education in South Africa. But I'm currently working in South Africa, in Sri Lanka, where in the Tamil region, and there's a lot of pressure post-tsunami to do women's education. But many of the young men only get educated at 10 years old, which is when they join the rebels. Now, to give an example of this, there's a school that we're working with where they built a secondary building for former child soldiers, but they don't have an education to the level where they can get to secondary school. Mm-hmm. So what the process is you get educated, you join the Tamil soldiers, and then you can get back into school. So I think we need to think about a holistic approach to education, both boys and girls.
Okay, just
same
one more.
In Colombia.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Joni Liebeck, and I just want to say the Aspen community has been amazing in helping. Three of us started out sending computers to Bosnia. We got them from Morgan Stanley. We got them from the foundation in New York. The big Imelda was a major help. The big expense is sending them there. And then Liberia said they don't have one in their university. So we sent half of them from Bosnia to Liberia, since they have to be connected to the outside world. Now we're helping build schools in Benin and West Africa, and it's only $300 to get somebody off the street in these schools that are really beginning to blossom in West Africa. And it was amazing. I was in Benin, and it was 110 degrees on a Saturday, and these kids showed up to school for tutoring. They don't have electricity, they don't have water, and they showed up in white pressed shirts with blue trousers and blue skirts, and they captured my heart when we talked, and they want to be doctors and agronomists and social workers and midwives. And I thought, I'm in Africa, 1 minute, they could be my kids, you know, they could be my next door neighbor. I mean, the power of the individual and of the community is so great to start somewhere. And if anybody wants to help us with any of those projects, we're not many more than three.
Let me just follow up with sort of listening to what I heard there. I think there are a lot of solutions that are being used in the different parts of the world, and just follow up with, in terms of some of those kinds of solutions, Where do those work? What works in the U.S. is not necessarily going to work in the Middle East, is not necessarily going to work in Africa. What kinds of solutions apply to what regions? And why don't we close with that?
Do you want to go first?
What we have been doing in Jordan is looking at examples, such as Costa Rica is one of them, Ireland, Singapore. And what we have been doing is localizing that experience. One of the issues that came up was soft skills. How do you invest in developing those soft skills, which are important? But one company, for example, is Intel, that has a program called the Computer Clubhouse. And there is one in Jordan that was established. And that's developing many of those soft skills. It's also empowering women by giving them access to technology where they can learn more through their access to the internet, and they can contribute to share projects. So I believe it's an issue of localization. Certainly, there should not be a cookie-cutter approach, but taking best practices and localizing those can go a long way.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to address your point, and it's a great one. We just returned back from Central America with Salma Hayek and Juanes and Ashley Judd, and we did a big tour. And along the way, in each of the countries, we didn't go to Costa Rica, unfortunately, but we did go to Guatemala and El Salvador and met with the presidents and spoke to them about the issues. And what we saw was very effective is we've set these centers up for kids that bribe them to come in with airtime on the computer. I don't know whether you call it airtime, but we provide them with computers for half an hour in exchange for half an hour of their time to listen to whatever topic we want to talk to them about. And I think that that's very effective, and we want to do more of that. Mr. Sinclair, did I get your name right?
Yes.
Yeah. You are absolutely spot on. You made a lot of sense with what you were saying. Of course, we have a situation with poverty. And so with poverty, we have malaria, TB, clean water is such a huge issue where we need to start. And to combine it with the gentleman's comment before, we've actually started collaborating with Procter & Gamble with their product Pure, which is a water purifier. And what we're doing, because we have the infrastructure around the world to actually get these water cleaning products to the people who need them in the rural villages. So they're donating the product and we're getting it out there. So yeah, absolutely, that's what needs to be done. And then thirdly, I think that we have an enormous opportunity with these high-tech companies, Microsoft and Gates obviously is doing a lot, but they're interested in supplying computers to schools in the developing world, and I really think that they need to step it up.
I'll go slightly, not higher altitude, but maybe more general. I think, and it's something we've talked about earlier, I think one thing that's absolutely critical is that we try to achieve some greater unity of purpose in trying to address the problem of disenfranchised youth, that we try to see how possible it might be to better organize and integrate the different approaches and strategies mm-hmm. of the public and mm-hmm. private sectors, mm-hmm. of NGOs mm-hmm. and other actors in this field around the world, which also is exchanging best practices mm-hmm. and enabling, I think, a far more efficient use mm-hmm. of resources. It's a huge challenge, but it is something that really needs to be tackled head mm-hmm. on because there are limited resources. I think that Kofi Annan, where the international donor community is, the role of the United States, as well as so many other stakeholders, it's so important to give globalization a human face, mm-hmm. a humane mm-hmm. function in trying to tackle these global problems mm-hmm. that have so much to do with what we're experiencing today, but as we've all discussed, pose such enormous challenges and exponentially greater challenges to coming generations because of the youth bulge. And then one last particular point, just in terms of the whole idea of mutual dialogue and exploring different options. There are programs like Seeds of Peace, which started off as a program to bring together Israeli and Palestinian and Arab young people to focus on promoting better understanding, a human face to the conflict, a sense of solidarity among young children across a conflict divide who are seeking to use political and social and cultural means to pressure decision makers to reach, you know, to understand the common ground and then to build on that through to ultimately achieve a resolution of the conflict based on mutual security needs, mutual understanding and respect for both sides. It has expanded now to focus on young people from across conflict lines in many other parts of the world. And I think that, you know, their focus on conflict management training, on mediation, on democracy and communication skills is very, very important for young people in different parts of the world. Again, it provides another avenue. And truly, these are seeds of peace and stability in their communities and increasingly in the larger world.
Thank you. I'd like to thank my panelists for discussing the beginnings of solutions to a very difficult problem, and it's something that I think we need to bring more discussion to.